Our next case, 10-1949, State of Ohio versus LaRue A. Montford. Mr. Adair.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice, members of the court. This case comes from Franklin County, where Mr. Montford was convicted of murder and attempted murder and received a 28-year-to-life sentence. The issue is that at some point early in these proceedings, counsel who died before the trial started entered on his behalf a plea of not guilty by reason of insanity.
Sir, would you pull the microphone a little closer? Thank you.
Does that help?
I hope.
Approximately 2 months after arraignment, the original attorney for Mr. Montford entered a plea by leave of court of not guilty by reason of insanity. Funds were allocated for an evaluation of Mr. Montford. There's an invoice indicating that this was done, and that's the last the record shows that this insanity plea was addressed. The case proceeded through the better part of a year. The original attorney, Mr. Schwartz, had cancer and eventually succumbed a couple days before the trial began. Meanwhile, another attorney was appointed to take over the case, initially as co-counsel, eventually tried the case by himself. It appears that this attorney was never aware of the insanity plea. He certainly never addressed it.
Well, wait a second. Do you know that he was never aware of it, or you know that he never addressed it?
He never addressed it.
Okay, so you don't know that he was not aware of the initial insanity plea?
The record shows nothing indicating that he was at all aware of it.
Okay, and then the evaluation was not contained?
It's not in the court file. And there's no cover letter. Frequently, when there's been a competency evaluation, there's a cover letter. Perhaps on insanity evaluations, there's sometimes a cover letter. The reports typically are not put in the file for the same sort of
But the report would have been given. The report would have been given to the attorney for the defendant here.
We would think so.
But there's no. The entire defense was, it wasn't me. You've misidentified it. I didn't do it, and that's totally inconsistent with an NGRI defense.
So well, as that went forward, sure, but we're talking about someone whose sanity has been placed in issue in the same type of delusional background that may have to do with. Committing an offense when you're legally insane may also lead a person to be in denial later on and to do that. The problem is we just don't know. We were purely speculating what
is there a difference between the duty of the defendant to present a defense on competency versus NGRI? And incompetency, that goes to the basic issue of whether they can even stand trial, whereas insanity is a defense that they have to raise. And there's a difference in those two standards, isn't there?
Well, they're certainly completely different, and a person can be competent and still be insane. In fact, the people who eventually go to trial are ultimately all found competent. There's no necessity that a person who, in fact, was legally insane at the time of offense ever have been incompetent.
Is this an issue that really should be more addressed on a different type of appeal?
We have to advance it in the direct appeal. Okay. It's manifest in the record that there's been a not guilty by reason of insanity plea. It's manifest in the record that it was never addressed in any form at trial.
And is there a requirement for there to be, and it seems in reading the briefs here that seems to be in dispute, whether once made an NGRI plea, that it has to be repealed or by the defendant, saying, I'm no longer going to assert an NGRI, I am going to pursue a different strategy at trial. There's a requirement to do that?
Our contention is that due process requires that. There's no statutory requirement, there's no rule requirement that I'm aware of.
The defense attorney notify the court and opposing counsel that I'm no longer going to assert that?
Yes. Well, no, the court has the primary obligation to dispose of the insanity plea.
Well, don't
it's been
the
put
rules
there, it shapes the course of litigation. I think the court has the primary obligation to see that the not guilty plea is disposed of, to see that a jeopardy plea is disposed of.
But two pleas can be entered, can they not? Not guilty and not guilty by reason of insanity?
Yes.
What's the purpose of the rule, in your view, of permitting both pleas to be interposed?
Well, there's the general denier of culpability. It's not essential to an insanity plea is not a plea in avoidance. You don't have to concede criminal culpability. Also, an indictment may be very broad, and you might concede some parts but not other parts.
But if the case is tried, as Justice Stratton points out, as an identity case, and there's no suggestion throughout the course of the proceeding about any other plea or any other defense, why wouldn't we say that that was waived by the defendant?
Because I don't see how we can have confidence in the ultimate fairness of the outcome of this trial if this plea, which would ordinarily shape the entire course of litigation, is not addressed in some form.
But if counsel, as a trial strategy, determined that the better course of action would be to proceed in connection with an identity case as opposed to another defense,
he's free to make that decision.
Who would the trial court or who would an appellate court be to say, we know a better strategy, that you should have done something different?
Well, this appellate courts don't have to choose a better strategy, but the trial court should be under an obligation to dispose of all pleas.
Where does that obligation originate?
The general notion of a fair trial embodied in due process.
Okay, and you don't think that the defendant can waive a defense?
Oh, the defendant can do these things, but it should be done. It needs to be done.
Well, by not raising it, doesn't it waive the defense?
No, I think that there has to be something affirmatively in the record to show that it was waived.
And when the defendant was given the right of allocution prior to sentencing and asked whether or not there's any reason why a sentence shouldn't be imposed or if the defendant wished to say anything, there was no statement by counsel or by the defendant at that point that the defense that I really had wasn't here. There wasn't any suggestion so that the court could have taken that under advisement considered it, right?
I think that's an unfair expectation, what a defendant's going to say at that particular point.
Or defense counsel?
Well, we do raise ineffective assistance of counsel here, that the attorney wasn't under a professional duty to either go forward with this defense
Clearly your client knew that he was examined, right, for a defense?
We believe he was because there was a bill submitted for it.
You don't know for a fact he was?
There was a bill submitted for it. I would assume that the examiner conducted the examination.
You don't have a copy of the report yourself?
No, never seen it.
You don't know who the examiner was?
Kristen Haskins.
And you never approached him to get a copy of that report?
I have not. I received this as an appeal, and of course the appeal has to be based on the record that is already closed at that point.
But certainly that report or a copy of it must be in existence, and you don't have it?
I don't have it, no.
Wouldn't that be a basis for determining ineffective assistance of counsel, for your individual reading of the report to see if it sustained a insanity plea or whether it discounted an insanity plea, which then would be pretty obvious as to why it wasn't introduced?
But we are here on direct appeal. We're not in a post-conviction action. And the obligation under Ohio law is that you have to raise records that are presented by the record in the direct appeal. And that's what we've done. And the elements that we know are the plea and the lack of any further mention in the transcript or in any further filings or anything else in the record.
So if we rule against you on the direct appeal, you still have available a post-conviction relief if the report shows.
Well, we would be past the deadline for doing that.
You're past the deadline for that?
Well, 180 days from the filing of the record in the Court of Appeals, and this was a trial that
Mr. Adair,
judgment entry went on roughly February 2009, so we would be well past that.
Okay. So,
go ahead. Mr. Adair, you're arguing that this is structural error.
That's correct.
The idea that a mistake so permeated the fairness of the trial, but it seems to me that you're arguing the simple fact of that the defendant did not withdraw the plea. I mean, the plea has to be in writing when it's an NGRI plea, and your argument is that it was never withdrawn, although from your recitation of the facts, it appears that the defendant totally abandoned that defense.
But again, we're speculating from a silent record what happened. We just simply don't know that plea suggested a certain course of action. It wasn't done. We don't know what the trial would have involved had it been pursued. We simply don't know.
So since your argument is that because there was no withdrawal of the NGRI, mm-hmm. that was a structural error.
Correct. We could also say that it's plain error and that it's not harmless. We don't. That's an alternative means of analysis. We would contend it's structural error, patterning our arguments after State versus Sandusky, which is another Court of Appeals opinion that involved comparable circumstances. The structural error analysis was in that opinion, although that case had been briefed as a plain error argument. But we would commit as plain error and not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Also, that a structural error would be alternative ways of approaching it.
Counsel, I guess I'm having the same problem I had with the lawyers on the last case, as the chief has asked you. Is there any reason that whatever evaluation was done would be unreachable or inaccessible to you?
As a practical matter, I don't know what would happen if I made a request for it. I assume that since I would be counsel, if I could get...
You could get it.
I could probably get it. They might request a release.
And it seems to me we have rules that encourage lawyers not to engage in a frivolous practice or a frivolous appeal. So if you got it... And you learned that the doc said... He's as sane as the next man. Mm-hmm. Then you're down to an argument that Justice Lansinger was just developing, that this is structural, plain and simple.
But I don't see how I can make that report a part of the record. And I think that my obligation as appellate counsel, as I see this issue, I can't simply ignore it when it's presented by the record.
Okay.
I don't see how I can ignore that.
Counsel, is what could have potentially occurred, which would have been the pursuit of a NGRI, could that have coexisted with the defense that was actually proffered, witness identification failings?
Well, I think they are inconsistent because generally insanity would concede that the person was present but acted.
Pardon me?
Generally, an insanity plea would concede presence, agency, whatever.
They weren't conceding presence whatsoever.
But I mean, that wasn't. I'm agreeing with you that they would appear to be inconsistent. But there's no requirement of first admitting everything. You can still challenge the state's proof as far as that. But then you could go ahead with identity. It would weaken you in front of the jury, certainly.
But the not guilty by reason of insanity presumes that you're going to say, "Yes, I was there. Yes, I did it." And I was insane at the time I did it and am not culpable for my actions, correct?
Well, I guess, but I guess there's also the question of how delusional the individual is and what they would be willing to say.
Okay, but the basis for the NGRI is not based on the delusions of the defendant and how that's operating. It's what the legal requirements are for not guilty by reason of insanity involves an admission of the commission of the act.
But I think you still examine the defendant's mind at the time of the alleged offense. You find out what the stressors in his life were, his patterns of thought, and those sorts of things. Again, I think a jury is going to be bothered by pursuing both defenses, but I think you're entitled to do so.
Okay.
I'll reserve any time that I might have left.
Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I heard my friend Mr. Adair say that we are speculating from a silent record, and I submit that speculating from a silent record is not a basis to find structural error, and it's not a basis to find ineffective assistance of counsel. And ultimately, this appeal is governed by 3 points. First, the defense bears the burden of presenting sufficient evidence of NGRI to warrant an instruction. So when the defense presents no evidence of NGRI at trial, the trial judge's refusal to give an instruction is not any error at all, let alone plain or structural error.
Was there a request for such an instruction?
Pardon me, Your Honor?
Was there a request
for
an NGRI instruction at the trial level?
No, Your Honor.
There was no evidence of it?
No evidence
of
an NGRI.
There was no presentation of it?
No.
And why would the court give it?
That's my point exactly. There is no evidence of an NGRI, so even if a request was made, the trial court would be obligated to deny that request because it's the defendant's burden to present sufficient evidence to warrant an instruction. The second point that governs this appeal is that an NGRI plea by itself is not proof that an NGRI was going to be a valid defense. So a fair trial is not dependent on the trial court inquiring the defense of what its intentions are with respect to an NGRI plea. And no legal rule, constitutional or otherwise, requires the defense to choose between actively pursuing an NGRI defense or formally withdrawing the plea. And the third point that governs this appeal is that counsel is presumed competent, and unless there's specific evidence in the record showing otherwise, counsel is presumed to have handled an NGRI plea competently.
In the briefs, even though counsel didn't address it here, they claim a conflict with Chahansky. Although Chahansky seems to have a little different fact pattern, can you distinguish why that would not control? Because that court found that they did have an obligation to continue with the plea.
Sure. In Chahansky, the Third District talked about first the evidence that was presented in that case, and there the defendant talked about how it was a fleeing case, a failure to comply type case, and the defendant talked about how he fled from the police as a result of a panic attack. And it was a reflex action. And there was also some testimony in the record that he had recently been released from a psychiatric hospital. And so the Third District looked at that evidence and said, well, this defendant is presenting an NGRI defense. So under those circumstances, the trial judge should have instructed the jury on NGRI. Now,
But the counsel in that case had abandoned that NGRI defense like here and didn't request an instruction. But the trial court or the court of appeals found enough evidence in the record that it should have been
pursued.
Was that an ineffective assistance of counsel finding?
There was an ineffective assistance finding in Chahansky. And I think the ineffective assistance finding was based more on the fact that the defendant wanted to pursue an NGRI defense in that case. And the court concluded that based on the defendant's own testimony. And the Third District said that despite the defendant's apparent desire to pursue an NGRI defense, the trial lawyer was not was preventing him from fully pursuing that defense by not requesting the judge for an instruction. So the Third District said that the trial lawyer's failure to follow through with the NGRI defense deprive the defendant of a substantial right to enter into a plea.
And you believe that case is distinguishable from this case then?
I do, because first off, unlike in Chahansky, where there was at least some evidence that the defendant wanted to pursue an NGRI defense and was actually attempting to pursue that defense, here there's absolutely no evidence whatsoever that the defendant committed these acts as a result of a severe mental disease or defect that affected his ability to know right from wrong. And furthermore, there's no evidence at all on this record that the defendant even wanted to pursue an NGRI defense. He seemed fully on board with a misidentification defense.
In your view, Mr. Gilbert, could the misidentification and NGRI defenses have coexisted in this case?
Sure. There's nothing legally precluding the defense from pursuing both theories simultaneously, although, as has been pointed out, there is an internal tension, if not outright conflict, between pursuing those two defenses. But the fact that the defendant was so on board with a misidentification defense, I think is pretty strong evidence that he is not wishing to pursue an NGRI defense. And the mere fact that it's possible to pursue both defenses at the same time, I submit, is not enough to find structural error to require automatic reversal in this case.
In fact, wasn't the defendant complaining about his trial attorneys, the first one who passed away, the second one he had some grumblings about, but ultimately said, you know, he was satisfied. But his main complaint was that the identification expert hadn't, in his mind, timely discussed the case with him. He didn't reference his psychiatric or psychologist evaluation, he was concerned enough to bring it to the court's attention that the misidentification expert or the eyewitness expert was not giving him the requisite amount of time.
Right. There are some complaints through written letters, and also there was a hearing held. And then shortly before the trial, shortly before voir dire, the defendant spoke up again. And every time, his complaints were not on the choice of strategy. That was never the subject of any of his complaints. His complaints were things like, the lawyer's not visiting me in the jail enough, he's signing continuances without my permission, you know, things of that sort. And like you said, Chief Justice O'Connor, he complained about the ID expert not filing a report or something like that timely enough. But at no point did he ever complain that his attorneys were pursuing a strategy that he did not agree with. And if there's anything that we can learn from this record, is that this defendant knew how to speak up. When he had complaints about his lawyers, he knew how to articulate those complaints. And the fact that he never did disagree with the misidentification defense, I think, is telling, in that he was fully on board with that defense, and he was fully on board with not presenting an NGRI defense.
Mr. Gilbert, you said that there was no rule or case that currently states that there should be a withdrawal of an NGRI plea. And should that be changed? Should this court articulate such a rule?
No, Your Honor, I don't think so. Because, as I mentioned earlier, an NGRI plea is not proof that NGRI is a valid defense. The NGRI plea is typically the beginning of an NGRI investigation, not the end of it.
But it is required to be submitted in writing.
Yes.
To the court.
Yes, and the purpose of the plea is not to alert to everybody that this is a valid defense. It's just to alert the trial judge and the prosecutor that this is a possible defense, that the defendant is intending to investigate NGRI, and it might be a defense that's pursued at trial. And oftentimes, the NGRI plea is what triggers the NGRI evaluation. And the evaluation is going to be the centerpiece of the NGRI defense. So when the plea is entered, most of the time, we don't have the evaluation yet. So really, no one really has any idea whether the NGRI is going to be a valid defense. So
well,
when the
counsel, isn't that pretty much the same with a alibi witness? You've got to go through some certain procedural notifications if you're going to use an alibi, and there's even a timing issue there. But there's no, at least in my recollection, there's no requirement that if you decide not to use the alibi witness that you have to come forth and say, I'm not going to use the alibi witness. And I don't believe that that is able to be commented on by the prosecutor if you don't use an alibi defense.
That's right. I think the notice of alibi procedures in Rule 12.1, I think is it is, and the NGRI plea procedures are not exactly alike, but they're comparable, in that the purpose of both is to notify the judge and the prosecutor that this is a possible defense that's going to be pursued at trial. It's not a representation that it is going to be the defense. It's just saying we're contemplating it. It's a possible defense. And so just as a notice of alibi, if the defense ultimately decides not to pursue an alibi defense, nothing requires the defense to alert the judge or the state that they're changing their mind or they're pursuing something else. The same thing is with NGRI. And along those lines, the decision not to pursue an NGRI defense is not such a momentous decision that would require the defense to announce it publicly on the record. And if a defense does not announce that decision on the record, there's no reason to think that the trial is not going to reliably serve its function of determining the defendant's guilt or innocence. The state still has to prove the elements of the offense beyond a reasonable doubt, and so forth.
And even though you're talking about defense and we're really talking about a plea, does that make any difference? The fact that it's a not guilty by reason of insanity plea, and we're referring to it as a defense.
It makes a slight difference in the sense that the initial decision to plea is the defendant's decision. The rules of professional conduct talk about that, and that's what the cases like Tennis from the Sixth District talks about, and Sihansky makes a reference to this as well. So the fact that it's a plea is somewhat unique in the sense that the defendant has to be on board with the decision to plea, but the ultimate decision of whether to actually pursue the defense at trial is a strategic decision that the defendant and his lawyer have to make together. So beyond that, I don't think there's really any difference between choosing not to pursue an NGRI defense after having entered a plea versus choosing not to enter an alibi defense after having filed a notice of alibi. Briefly on the colloquy argument that the defense is raising, they're saying that the judge has an obligation to address the defense to determine what its intentions are with respect to the NGRI plea. I filed last week a supplemental authority citing the State versus Deal case from the late 60s and also a follow-up of Deal, State versus Johnson from 2006. And those cases talk about how a trial judge has no overall duty to inquire as to how the defense is handling the case unless the defendant himself or herself makes a specific complaint on the record. And the reason for that is because, as I mentioned earlier, judges are entitled to presume that counsel is handling the case competently. And so unless there's a specific complaint from the defendant on the record, judges are entitled to take that presumption to heart and assume that the defense is handling the case competently. And even if there was such a rule that required the judge to do that, that would be a procedural housekeeping type rule that would not be constitutional in nature, and it wouldn't affect the entire framework of the trial. And along those lines, if I can just offer a brief observation in conclusion, if on page one of the trial transcript in this case, the defense counsel, either on his own or prompted by the trial judge, had said the defense withdraws the insanity plea. Well, those six words would have presumably satisfied the two propositions of law that the defense is arguing for this morning. But in the absence of those six words, the defense is saying is structural error requiring automatic reversal. But saying those words would not have made this particular trial any more a reliable vehicle to determine the defendant's guilt or innocence. And in fact, had those words been said, I think it's fair to say that this trial would have presumed exactly the way it did. The same witnesses would have testified. They would have offered the same testimony. The parties would have given the same openings, the same closings. The judge would have given the same instructions, and ultimately the jury would have returned the same verdicts. So the absence of those six words is not structural error requiring automatic reversal, and it's not an effective assistance of counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Adair, you've saved a minute and a half.
I don't think most individuals going through court would embrace being found not guilty by reason of insanity. These are difficult clients that would probably be very difficult to even sell people many times on even entering that sort of plea, even when clearly that's the right way to go in a trial. I'd also note that Ohio doesn't bifurcate the determination of factual guilt and determination of sanity. If we did that, perhaps then you could have allow the defendant to challenge the eyewitness ID proof and so forth, but then get to what may well be the real issue, which would be his sanity at the time of the act. This court in Ohio law is generally very solicitous of certain rights, like the right to allocution, proper waiver, the right to counsel, what must be done during a Rule 11 colloquy. All we're really asking for here is that equal attention be paid to entering something as significant as a not guilty by reason of insanity plea, and it's a simple matter to place this burden on courts to address it when the plea is there and is of record. Thank you.
Thank you. We will take this matter under advisement, and you will be notified of our decisions. Thank you, gentlemen. Marshall, would you call a recess, please?